Welcome to the TAH Weekly COVID-19 Call. My name is Hilda, and I'll be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode, and later we will conduct a question-and-answer session. For the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star one using your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. And now I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Wendy Long. You may begin.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining our call today. This is our weekly call between the Hospital Association and the Department of Health. I know that we've heard from so many hospitals out there at how much they value this call and the opportunity to interact with and get some questions answered and receive important information from the department. We've got representing the Department of Health today, Dr. Amelia Keaton and Dr. Mary Margaret Phil. And also here from THA is Chris Clark. It's possible that I might have to drop off the call a little early, but Chris will be here if needed to facilitate. But without any further delay, I will turn it over to Amelia and Mary Margaret.
Hey, good morning, everyone. This is Dr. Mary Margaret Phil. I'm going to kick things off, and then Dr. Keaton and I are going to jump back and forth and tag team a few updates that we have for everyone, and then, of course, we'll leave plenty of time for questions at the end. So first, I just wanted to provide a really brief update on sort of the COVID-19 situation in Tennessee. Hopefully, all of you are well familiar with our website. We continue to update our numbers there at 2 p.m. every day. As of yesterday at 2 p.m., we had 2,845 laboratory-confirmed cases in Tennessee. As we discussed last week, we've added a few additional metrics to the website, including hospitalizations, fatalities, and then in the last couple of days, we've also added a data field around the number of patients who have recovered. So I'm going to speak a little bit more about each of those, again, just to provide some clarity. So as you all know and may recall from last week, that hospitalizations number is the patients that have ever been hospitalized. So it is not meant to be a real-time indicator of current hospital healthcare strain and capacity. It is just meant to be sort of a metric of overall disease severity, and we certainly recognize that there may be patients in whom that data point is not captured during our public health investigation process, so it's really a rough estimate. Fatalities are being reported to us through several different mechanisms. We ask that, you know, that clinicians that are aware of a fatality call us and report or that they report to the medical examiners, and we have a close working relationship with the Office of the State Chief Medical Examiner and their teams, as well as all of the regional forensic centers, to ensure that any case that's a possible COVID-19 associated fatality be reported to us. We're also doing just monitoring of death records, although that obviously will have quite a substantial lag, but as those death certificate data points come in, to ensure that there aren't any cases that are missed. And then this recovered data point is the newest one to be added this week. I do want to give a little bit of context because right now it's being created through a couple of different ways. So right now we have several public health jurisdictions that are continuing to have daily conversations with every patient. And so for those patients in those areas, the public health team can clearly assess when their symptoms have resolved and when they've completed their isolation period. So for a proportion of patients in the state, this number is based on those day-to-day interviews and completion of their isolation period plus complete resolution of their symptoms. There are, however, some other parts of the state where that degree of ongoing contact is just not possible due to the high volume of patients. And so in those areas, we're basically extrapolating that number and going 21 days out from when a patient's specimen was collected. And if they are not deceased from the illness, then we're assuming that by that point they should be recovered and have at least completed their isolation period. So it's not a perfect metric, but I think, is just meant to be another indicator for folks to work off of to understand where people are in that process of completing their isolation periods and things like that. So I just wanted to give a little bit of context about that. And then if you look at the county case count data, we're now providing breakdowns by county for the positive tests by county, negative tests by county, and deaths by county as well. I do want to make clear that especially for the negative test by county, we often do not get this information from laboratories when they report to us. So you will see that something like close to 5,000 of those data points are not known and will never be known. Our public health investigators are not doing any follow-up on negative labs, and so we anticipate that there will be a substantial proportion of negative tests that we can never accurately apply to their specific county just because of how that data is collected and how, unfortunately, incomplete it is sometimes in what we receive from laboratories. So, again, these are just meant to sort of speak to general trends, not be numbers that, especially that negative number that we really count closely from day to day. I'm going to switch gears completely, and I just wanted to provide an update. We had a call earlier this week with representatives from the Tennessee Hospital Association and Tennessee Healthcare Association to discuss this issue that has been one we've talked about many times on this call of the challenges that acute care hospitals may be having in transferring patients to long-term care facilities or SNFs around this idea of negative testing being required and things like that. And as we've talked about before, we certainly understand the concerns on both sides. And there is no, you know, magic perfect answer, I don't think, but we're trying to come to a set of maybe best practices that we can share among all groups to encourage a more seamless and standardized approach to these patients. So folks with THCA and THA are working on drafting some of that documentation, and then the Department of Health will review it, and hopefully we'll have that information available for folks by next week. Again, not meant to be a letter of the law type of document, but really best practices and guidance as to how folks can approach these situations, realizing that there are always going to be individual factors at play around PPE availability and availability to isolate patients and the capacity and bed availability in acute care hospitals and many factors that are all part of that. But this is just is meant to help be a guide for how to address those transfers. So look for that coming hopefully in the next week or so. And then I will turn it over to Dr. Keaton to speak more specifically about some recent updates and situations that we've encountered around cases in healthcare facilities.
Thanks, Dr. Phil. This is Dr. Amelia Keaton. Again, I am the interim director of the Healthcare Associated Infections Program at the Tennessee Department of Health. So a few updates based on what we've learned over the past few weeks with regards to COVID-19 in healthcare facilities. I know a lot of facilities have grappled with the issue of how to handle healthcare workers who end up being exposed to COVID-19 or who actually test positive for COVID-19. I think we in public health would really like to know of any instances of even a single healthcare worker who has potentially worked while symptomatic with COVID-19. And the reason is we know that healthcare workers tend to come in contact not only with their patients, but also a large number of other healthcare workers. And so I think performing contact tracing in those situations is really, really important. I know a lot of acute care hospitals tend to do some of this on their own. We are happy to help with that. And the sorts of things that we like to look at in situations where a healthcare worker is either exposed or has tested positive are when they last worked. Typically, we start those investigations or we start looking at the 24 hours before the worker develops symptoms. And then we try to evaluate if they came into contact with any patients or with any other staff members without wearing appropriate PPE. We do know that CDC has issued guidance, essentially presenting two options for facilities in terms of what to do with a healthcare worker who's been exposed to COVID-19. The safest and most conservative option, I think, is to exclude those workers for 14 days from their last exposure, recognizing, though, at this point in the epidemic that could potentially eliminate the majority of your workforce. And so the alternative is for healthcare workers to work their entire shift while wearing face masks or surgical face masks. And I think that this is a acceptable alternative to having that worker stay home. I think we all just need to be very cognizant of making sure that workers know how to wear those masks appropriately and that they know not to take the mask off in any settings, whether it's
even when they're not performing patient care. I think one concerning trend that we have seen in a variety of different facilities are healthcare workers who are working with what may not be recognized as COVID-19 symptoms, so a very mild runny nose, generalized malaise, or other symptoms that could be related to a variety of different things, but that ultimately end up being related to COVID-19. And so what we are cautioning folks to do is to look at their staffing now and see and ensure that their employees know not to come to work with symptoms of any kind. It's just too risky, particularly in settings like long-term care facilities or other perhaps non-healthcare workers, such as activities directors or other folks who don't fall into that classic healthcare worker field, but that are working within healthcare facilities. We know that those individuals tend to go, to several different rooms throughout facilities. And if those individuals are sick or even have mild symptoms, they have the potential to expose a wide number of patients. And so I think just being very cognizant of who is coming into and out of your facility and knowing that even if they don't have a fever, if they do have symptoms, they really should not be coming to work. I think that the magnitude of that is probably much broader than we recognize, and so it's really important to look at. Kind of along that same lines, if you identify any clusters of patients or healthcare workers in your facility that have COVID-19, we are requesting that you report those to us as well at the Tennessee Department of Health. We, again, can help with interviewing those folks and providing best practice guidelines for limiting the spread to others. I think one other point that is also really important to remember is that if you do have clusters of patients, whether in a long-term care facility or an acute care facility, or you have healthcare workers who potentially have symptoms of COVID-19, we are able to expedite some of those testing or their testing at our state lab so that we can get results back more quickly to help prioritize your actions and inform the next steps that you need to take in your facility. So I think we've dramatically increased our capacity at our state public health lab, and so that's a resource that we really encourage you to use if you're in a situation where you think you might have individuals within your facility who need testing. Another question that we have received a lot of inquiries about this week is the new reporting module in NHSN, which is the primary surveillance system for healthcare-associated infections across the United States. On March 27th, CDC announced a new module within NHSN to capture various data elements related to COVID-19. As many of you have pointed out, there's a lot of overlap between the fields collected in NHSN and with our HRTS, or Healthcare Resource Tracking System, in Tennessee. I think it's important to point out that NHSN's new module is voluntary. You are certainly welcome to report that or report into that module if you would like. We're still encouraging everybody, though, to continue giving us those data points in HRTS because that allows us to take more quick action and allows us to get a better snapshot of what's happening at our state level. And we are still working with CDC to explore kind of how they're using that data collected through NHSN to guide their actions to see how we could possibly help those systems work together to get the best data possible. And I think with that, the only other thing that I wanted to mention is that something that has come up a few times is the decontamination or reprocessing of N95s. I know several facilities have inquired about using UV light systems for this. So CDC released some formal guidance on this yesterday, with the main take-home message being that if you have a UV light system or other sterilizing or disinfecting system, if that system has a set of guidelines or procedures for using that to reprocess N95 masks, it is acceptable to use that and consider those masks safe to use in any settings. If the system that you have on site does not have a set of those procedures, they cannot really guarantee that those will be effective in removing potential pathogens or contaminants to those N95 masks if they're used for extended or reuse. And you can find a more detailed set of those guidelines on CDC's COVID-19 website if you're interested in that. They really break it down by the types of activities and the types of systems that are used. And so with that, I don't have anything further. Dr. Phil, do you have any other updates that you'd like to provide before we open it up for questions?
No, I don't think so. I do just want to reemphasize the points that you made about HRTS and the healthcare resource tracking system. First, I just want to thank many facilities are doing an amazing job of going in and putting in data every day. However, there are still some facilities that are not, and, you know, we're working to identify those facilities and support them as best we can. I will just say, you know, for those on the call that are in leadership positions of facilities across the state, you know, we're hearing from our teams on the ground that, you know, really work with the point folks in many facilities that often they are working 12-hour days and just have so much going on, and this is not a priority. And so if there can be a way to help support, ensure that the people doing this data entry in every facility have the support to make it happen. There are really big decisions at the state level being made about surge capacity and alternate care sites and things like that that are all based on this data. And so we need it to be as accurate as possible. And so I know it's yet one more task for people to do, but we're really hopeful that by feeding accurate information into this system, we can make the best decisions for all of the facilities across the state and for our population, but it really depends on the folks on the front lines doing that data entry work. And just to echo what Amelia said, if we can only report into one system, we prefer you report into HRTS. The NHSN module is optional, and for us, the HRTS data will be utilized much more regularly. So thanks again for all that are working on that, and we really appreciate your partnership in those efforts. And I think those are all the updates, so we're happy to open the line for questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. If you'd like to cancel your request, you can press the pound sign or the hash key. And if you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if there are any questions, please press star 1. There may be a delay before the first question is announced. Please stand by. We have a caller online with a question. If you can please state your name prior to stating your question.
Hey, this is Randy Davis from Northcrest. My question is about the HRTS system. We were on a discussion yesterday about surge capacity and alternative sites. To my understanding, the way that we're doing HRTS right now, it's based on our 72 active beds that we have. It doesn't accurately reflect what we could surge to, especially around CCU beds. So I was wondering if there's a way that we can better reflect our surge capacity in HRTS.
Yeah, hey, this is, oh, go ahead.
Can I take that maybe? Randy, we're going to be actually reaching out to hospitals as a result of the board call yesterday to talk about how we want to report surge. I mean, you're absolutely right. HRTS right now is not designed to accept surge data. It is on your current bed capacity.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1.
This is Chris at THA. While we're waiting to see if anyone has another question, I have a question for Dr. Keaton and Dr. Phil. So as we look at healthcare workers and that risk and concern about their exposure, has the documentation or the recommendation changed at all, moving towards more active screening of all workers and active preventive masking for all staff, or what's the stance currently on that?
Yeah, this is Amelia Keaton. So I think probably the best recommendation we can offer is that if you have healthcare workers, in, we would recommend doing screening for symptoms and for temperatures when they come in for their shifts. I think at this point the exposure for many healthcare workers, regardless of the setting, is I think we should assume that there is always the potential that people have been exposed, and so just doing very quick symptom checks and temperature checks would probably be the safest option across the board, I would think. I don't know if CDC has come out with a formal recommendation to say that, but I do think that if it's something that your facility has the capacity to do, it's probably safest to institute that now. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Phil.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we've seen many facilities have implemented some sort of screening for workers at the starts of their shifts. You know, to your point about masking, you know, we've seen some guidance, you know, I believe some hospitals, Massachusetts General, others have implemented guidance themselves for, that all of their healthcare workers remain masked. There's not any formal guidance right now from CDC to require that all healthcare workers be masked at all times. You know, certainly, as Dr. Keaton said, if a healthcare worker has had a known exposure to a case or either in their as another coworker or a patient, if they aren't able to be furloughed, then we would undoubtedly want those people to be masked at work. I think we also have to be thoughtful, and now is a good time for people to brush up on their donning and doffing procedures. I think we're seeing potentially a lot of cross-contamination happening when people are taking masks and things on and off. So we have some good guidance and some videos that I think are really great from Emory that we're happy to share with you, Chris, to be disseminated to the group because, you know, we're busy and stressed and supplies are limited, but we still need to be really thoughtful about how we're taking those things on and off because we're often introducing contamination at those times. So right now, no mandate that everyone wear masks at all times. However, if a hospital system chooses to do that for their workers, they certainly within their right to do that, but there's not official state guidance to that effect.
Yeah, and I'll also just add that I think what several states and healthcare systems have seen is that once one healthcare worker is identified, there often are several others who may be pre-symptomatic or have very mild symptoms, and I think that is the reason for some places adopting universal masking, which I think is complicated by the fact that there is a shortage of PPE across the nation and in pretty much every healthcare facility. But I do think it is something maybe considering at your hospital level on how you would want to approach that problem and what you think would be best for your system.
Thank you.
We have a question from Dan. Please go ahead.
I asked a question, but it wasn't Ken, but I'll take the slot. Dr. Brown, hi, everybody. Dr. Brown with Covenant. Two questions, please. The first one following up on what Dr. Phil was saying, if I heard you correctly, you're talking about wanting to be involved in contact tracing with any healthcare worker that may have tested positive or may have been exposed to someone who's tested positive. You know, we don't have a lot of positive healthcare workers yet, but we've had a fair number of people who are exposed. And the guidance that we're getting from our local health departments is that they no longer want to be involved in tracing because it's too massive for them. I'm happy to involve the state and certainly let you know what we're doing, but one of my concerns is that going to slow our process down in getting these folks potentially back to work? And, you know, we're doing all the things you've talked about with furloughs versus masks versus testing mid-quarantine, all sorts of things. Obviously, we want to get the people we can get back to work, particularly essential people, back as well. So I just want to get some clarity on your role in that tracing and what your expectation might be so they're not slowing our process down internally.
Sure. This is Amelia Keaton. So I will say that we certainly do not have to be involved in contact tracing. I think we just want to, if your facility feels comfortable doing that, that is absolutely appropriate, and we will defer to you to conduct that. I think we've become aware of situations where maybe facilities who have fewer resources or not as robust employee health or infection preventionist programs may need some assistance with that, and we're happy to help with that. But I think if your facility feels comfortable doing that sort of thing, that's totally appropriate, and we wouldn't want to slow down that investigation if you feel comfortable leaving it.
Okay. Great.
Yeah, this is Dr. Phil. I'll just add, you know, I think some of this is around communication, not us being in the nitty-gritty weeds with you guys as you do your contact tracing.
Okay.
I think what Dr. Keaton said is exactly appropriate. You know, I think much of this is intended for facilities that don't have the infection control support or aren't clear on what to do around patient notifications or masking staff or those sorts of things. So for facilities that are comfortable with that, you know, have at it. I think, however, if you identify, you know, a cluster of 5 healthcare workers and 25 patients that have been exposed, and there's going to be big patient notifications and lots of action. If it's possible, if there's a way just to give us a heads up that that's happening, I think it's appreciated. You know, communication around this whole situation is challenging, and things move fast. Often rumors move faster than facts, and so it can be helpful for us before, you know, our regional health officers or our commissioner get a phone call from someone about, you know, what's happening in this facility. If we can have just some knowledge of the reality of what's happening and the response that's happened, then that can be really helpful in ensuring and keeping people from panicking unnecessarily. So we don't need that sort of notification anytime you have a single healthcare worker necessarily. It's more if there seems to be a situation that you're trying to stay on top of. We appreciate being in the loop if that's possible.
All right, thank you for that. And if I may, a second question, probably more for Dr. Wong and for Chris. You know, we're all, I think, in the same boat across the state right now, trying to look at our crystal balls, and maybe it's more like the magic eight ball, to try to, you know, solve for a number of beds that we think we may need in our individual local communities. We've all seen statewide models, but do you at the THA level have zip code level information? I've seen some county level information, but not, you know, the detailed information I'd like to see on what's the end we're trying to solve for, best and worst case scenario for available beds. Because when I see 7,800 beds across Tennessee in the Washington model, you know, I'm backing into math based on percentage of population, et cetera. I just would be interested to know what model we're all working off of, so we can all kind of solve for roughly the same end, knowing it's a range. But can you share the models you're working from and what we should be using locally and how we can get that information?
Yes, this is Wendy. And, you know, we don't have any more sophisticated models than I think you do. We discussed this a bit on the board call yesterday. You know, definitely the Washington model is one that folks are looking at. Vanderbilt is working on a model. But honestly, it has, I don't know how many different variables that you put into it, and each one of those variables you have to make assumptions around, and you know, where you come in with those assumptions can cause the ultimate outcome to vary wildly. So I think we all wish at every level that we had a better predictor. You may see in the news this morning that everybody is now questioning the model that they've put out nationally around numbers of deaths. And,
right.
You know, I don't think that any of us have that. What we've got to do is think about, you know, what is our maximum surge capacity internally? What can you all do, even if it's in some ways theoretical, right? If you were able to get in all the staff that you needed, what could you surge to by doubling up patients in rooms or turning ambulatory surgery centers into, you know, an inpatient unit? What are the opportunities there, knowing that you're going to have to implement that over a period of time as we actually see that caseload moving up? And then do we need, and how would we, and who would we place in alternative care sites that might allow you to increase your throughput and get your lower acuity patients out of the hospital?
Yeah, we're of course, like every other health system, doing that. I know we're all moving quickly on this, but at some level, whether it's at the governor's office or PEMA, you know, somewhere somebody's solving for a number of potential beds in worst case scenario in the state of Tennessee, and somewhere somebody's got that on a chart by zip code. I can't imagine they don't. So again, I'm not trying to be a fly in the ointment here, but the more of that information that we get, the more we can be helpful in communicating with one another locally at our health systems, regionally, and at the state level, because none of us have the bandwidth to be duplicating efforts. So that's what we're trying to get out in front of, And the more that granular information, even if it's wrong, that we're all working off the same wrong, would be very helpful.
We hear you.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. We have one more question. One moment. We have a question from Michelle.
My question is, for trach patients that have an open trach, are there any other requirements for PPE, say even before they show symptoms and after?
This is Amelia Keaton. So I don't think that we have specific guidance for patients who have an open trach other than just really stringent infection prevention and control that you would do ordinarily. I think if they have been exposed to somebody with known COVID-19, I think we would obviously recommend, if that patient is hospitalized, that they be on contact droplet precautions with eye protection. But beyond that, I don't think we have any specific guidance that we would recommend.
Thank you once again. For any questions, please press star 1. At this moment, we show no further questions.
All right. Well, we want to thank Dr. Keaton and Dr. Phil for joining us this morning. And let's see, next week, I believe this call next week, because Friday is Good Friday, is going to be at 11 o'clock on Thursday, and that's Central Time. So thank you all again. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes your conference call. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.